man in the clearing, watching each reach up idly to scratch his neck at what he imagined was an insect bite. By the time the eighth and last man noticed something wrong, it was much too late to do anything about it. The squad dropped to the dirt in eerie unison. Later we descended from the hill and requisitioned the supplies for our own unit, stepping over corpses grotesquely bloated from internal explosions. That was my first dreamlike taste of death. Sometimes I wondered what would have happened if the delay had been set to less than 15 seconds, so that the first man dropped before I'd finished putting slugs in the others. Would I have had the true sniper's nerve, the cold will to carry on regardless? Or would the shock of what I was doing have rammed home so brutally that I would have dropped the gun in revulsion? But I always told myself that there was no point dwelling on what might have happened. All I did know was that after the first series of unreal executions, it was never a problem again. Almost never. It was in the nature of a sniper's work that one almost never saw the enemy as anything other than an impersonal stick figure, too far away to be humanized by either facial details or an expression of pain when the slug found its mark. I almost never needed to send another slug. For a time, I thought I'd found a safe niche where I could psychologically barrier myself from the worst that the war had to offer. I was valued by my unit, protected like a talisman. Although I never once did anything heroic, I became a hero by virtue of my technical skill at aiming a gun. If such a thing were possible in any kind of combat, I was happy. In fact, I knew it was possible. I'd seen men and women for whom the war was a capricious and spiteful lover, one who would always hurt them, but to whom, bruised and hungry, they would inevitably return. The greatest lie ever told was the one that said war made us universally miserable, that if the choice was truly ours, we would free ourselves of war forever. Maybe the human condition would have been something nobler if that were the case, but if war did not have a strange and dark allure, why did we always seem so unwilling to abandon it for peace? It went beyond anything as mundane as acclimatization to the normality of war. I had known men and women who boasted of sexual arousal after killing an enemy, addicted to the erotic potency of what they had done. My happiness, though, was simpler, born out of the realization that I'd found the luckiest of roles. I was doing what I rationalized as morally right, while at the same time being sheltered from the very real risk of death that usually accompanied frontline forces. I assumed it would continue like that, that eventually I would be decorated, and that if I didn't stay a sniper until the war's end, it would be only because the army considered my skills too valuable to risk in the front line. I suppose it was possible I might have been promoted to one of the covert assassination squads, certainly more hazardous, but as far as I could see it, the most likely outcome would be a training role in one of the boot camps, followed by early retirement and the smug assurance that I'd helped expedite the war's conclusion. Of course, it didn't happen like that. One night, our unit got ambushed. We were cut down by guerrillas of an NC deep incursion squad, and in minutes I learnt the true meaning of what was euphemistically described as close quarters combat. No line of sight particle beam weapons now, no delayed detonation nano munitions. What close quarters combat meant was something which would have been infinitely more recognizable to a soldier of 1,000 years earlier, the screaming fury of humans being packed so close together that the only effective way to kill each other was with sharpened metal weapons, bayonets and daggers, or with hands around each other's throats. Fingers pressed into each other's eye sockets. The only way to survive was to disengage all higher brain functions and regress to an animal.